How are we doing, Severn? My name's Aaron. I'm part of the teaching team here. If you're just hopping in for the first time, today we're going to end a series of talks that highlight the call on the church to be on mission in her sphere of influence. The last time I spoke to you, we discussed how an encounter with Jesus changes everything. How if Jesus is on mission, anyone who comes in contact with Jesus is on mission. We looked at how Jesus operated in the sphere of influence of the first century church in both formal contexts, those would be synagogues, and informal contexts in living rooms, dining rooms, and neighborhoods to continue his mission. We talked about how we can only understand our relationship with our neighbors, family members, co-workers, and the people we cross paths with in the context of our relationship with Jesus. We also touched on some of the characteristics of being on mission in our spheres of influence and how this should happen organically in our living rooms, our dining rooms, at the gym, on the sidelines of our kids' soccer games, in our neighborhoods, wherever we find ourselves. Our efforts should be word deploying in the sense that we politely and respectfully bring the message of Jesus to bear on the human condition. We looked at how engagement in the mission should be active, not passive, as each of us begins to interact with the people in our spheres of influence to build relationships that allow people to understand what Jesus' mission is about while alerting them to the reality that Jesus is the resolution to our aspirations, fears, and hopes. And simply stated, friends, Jesus' mission is to make broken people whole. Lastly, we looked to Jesus as the ultimate missionary who is found interacting in the margins. He's found seeking and saving the lost. He's found healing the sick, lame and blind. He's found consoling those who are mourning. He's found defending the outcast. And ultimately, he's found exhibiting unconditional love, being humiliated so that we wouldn't have to be, bearing our guilt and our shame so that we could experience new life centered on the God who cares for us and the people who God cares for, rather than lives centered on ourselves, our own happiness, our own goals, and our own disordered intuitions. And ultimately, because of what Jesus has done, we can now serve God and others freely because we are accepted, not in a religious sense as a result of our good works, but in the context of the gospel as a result of Jesus' finished work. Let's go ahead and get to work this morning. So for the past 2,000 years and counting, the movement Jesus launched has spread from its epicenter in Jerusalem to reach major cities, suburbs, remote villages, and homes around the world. The aim of the movement has always been focused on including people from every nation, tribe, and tongue. In other words, the nations, people of all shapes and sizes, ethnic backgrounds, political regions, linguistic groups, are part of the drama that we read about in the text of the Bible and the drama that plays out through our daily lives. The exposition and conflict of this drama commenced thousands of years ago and is outlined in the first 11 chapters of Genesis. The plot line continued throughout history, reaching a point of climax with God fully revealing himself to us and dwelling amongst us in Jesus. And through Jesus, God is cutting a clear path through the weary and plotting activities of men in order to rescue a people for himself. And he's not going to stop until a multitude without number is secured from every nation, tribe, and tongue. If this is God's plan to rescue people everywhere, we must ask ourselves, what in the world does this mean for us as people staking a claim that Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life? The first three chapters of Genesis outline the creation of all things by one God, our rebellion against God, and God's promise to remedy the conflict we created between God and all of creation. Chapters 4 through 11 describe the devastating outcome of our rebellion as the progressive alienation of human beings from God and each other. What I'm referring to is highlighted and graphically described in the account of God's destruction of the Tower of Babel and his scattering of people into different nations distinguished by ethnicity and language. This setting, one of moral bankruptcy and relational despair, is the setting in which God interacts with one man, Abraham, outlining his promise not to abandon the human race, but to rescue and restore it. God initiated his mission through establishing a relationship with Abraham and Abraham's family, which leads me to my first point, that God has always been on mission. Turn with me to Genesis chapter 12, where we read, "The Lord said to Abram, 'Go out from your land, your relatives, and your father's house to the land that I will show you. I will make you into a great nation. I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you. I will curse those who treat you with contempt. And all the peoples on earth will be blessed through you. So Abram went, as the Lord had told him, and Lot went with him. Abram was 75 years old when he left Haran. At first glance, it appears that God's interests are laser-focused on one family. However, this story, understood in the context of the entire narrative of the Bible, ensures us that this is not the case. Instead, this promise to Abraham represents God's opening move in his mission to rescue the world. In order to communicate his love to the world, God chose a people. You see, it started with Abraham and his family and eventually evolved to be known as Israel. And God's intense concern for Israel throughout the entire Old Testament, even when they turn their backs on God time and time again, demonstrates two things. First, it affirms our own moral corruption, which demands an intervention to radically transform the way we think, the way we work, how we treat each other, our perception of the world, and ultimately, our relationship with God. Secondly, it demonstrates God's ardent, unwavering, unconditional love that is not contingent upon our good works. Rather, it's secure in His. So from the very beginning, Israel, from its distinctive identity, was intended to speak to the nations, love their neighbors, and introduce the world to the God who loved them. Unfortunately, Israel, much like us, did a really good job reaffirming their moral bankruptcy, and they routinely struggled to live out of their distinctive identity. Time and time again, they lost sight of the plan, and time again, God pursued the people that He loved, reminding them of their identity in Him and of His mission to rescue the world. Which leads me to the next point I would like to emphasize. God's mission is clarified in Jesus. You see, time and time again, God spoke through the prophets of Israel to recalibrate Israel to the mission that God had for them and the purpose that God had to rescue and restore the entire world. And for the duration of the Old Testament, to a certain extent, Israel stood with a level of unclarity with regards to their distinctive identity and the purpose to which they'd been called. When Jesus comes, however, what He does is He endorses each and every one of the promises that God had communicated to Abraham, Israel, and all the prophets. And in essence, Jesus is the true Israel, because He is who the prophets spoke of and longed for. He's a better version of each and every one of Israel's greatest leaders, and ultimately, He's the fulfillment of the entire Jewish law, meaning that Jesus' life was a real-life display of what it means to live out of a God-given identity and to fully engage in God's mission to rescue the world. So essentially, Jesus is the blessing that God promised Abraham in the world. Jesus is the way in which all the nations of the earth can be blessed. And I'd like to illustrate the aim of Jesus' mission with a story. So on January 1st, 1863, about 152 years ago, President Abraham Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation amidst the third year of a blood-riddled Civil War. And despite being issued by the president himself, the declaration surrounding the freedom of slaves, at least within rebellious states, produced no immediate effect. On the contrary, adherence to the contents of the Emancipation Proclamation remained contingent upon the success of Union forces in battle. In other words, freedom for slaves rested not upon the Declaration itself, but upon the victory of those asserting the necessity of freedom for blacks in America. So although the Emancipation Proclamation in no wise ended slavery, an interesting concept emerges from its impact on the Union Army and Navy. What followed Lincoln's order transformed the posture of some blacks in America. Now, being accepted into the Union Army and Navy, no longer were they required to stoop under the oppressive arm of those who claimed a stake in their ownership. Rather, a newfound freedom positioned them as members of an active agency against injustice. And with their necessity for liberation being quenched, those liberated were now enjoined to the cause of liberation. So in a manner superior to that of Lincoln, Jesus is enlisting freedmen. Those are believers in Jesus as ambassadors, heralds of the good news of liberation from the bondage of sin. The Emancipation Proclamation published by Jesus in the permanent ink of His perfect life, His sacrificial death, and His glorious resurrection, unlike the transient document drafted by Lincoln, is the gospel, which is the power of God for salvation, redemption, deliverance, a means of escape, help, a lifeline to everyone who believes, for all time. And as the supreme liberator, Jesus has proclaimed an invincible emancipation from the deadly tentacles of the slavery of sin. And through his death on the cross, Jesus ultimately and utterly demolished the slave driver, thus ensuring freedom from sin. And although this freedom is not contingent upon the advancement of an earthly militia, nor is it like the freedom that the world purports, Jesus has enlisted men, women, and children living in community and on mission together to proclaim it to the captive, both here, in here, and out there. This sense of security, what Jesus has secured, is not temporal. Instead, it's a freedom that's guaranteed by the possessor of all authority and power in heaven and on earth, namely Jesus. You see, oppression comes at the hand of oppressors. However, liberation is birthed from the efforts of liberators. Abraham Lincoln utilized his free state to declare war on slavery, and in so doing, enlisted freedmen in the war waged against oppressors. Jesus freely laid down his life as a ransom for slaves, and it is through Jesus that slaves are ultimately liberated. It is by Jesus that those loosed from slavery to sin are enlisted in the ultimate liberation plan. Which leads me to the final point that I'd like to present you with, that God continues his mission through us. For nearly 1,000 years, the church in the Western world, places like Europe and North America, has operated in a cultural context that missiologists, these are people who study the mission of the church, describe as Christendom. Simply explained, Christendom can be understood as the structures of a society that employ the moral principles of Christianity. A prime example of this type of society is the United States of America, which is commonly referred to as a Christian nation. And being undergirded with certain principles that trace their origin right back to God himself, countries like the USA have successfully Christianized people, all the while stigmatizing non-Christian behavior. Unfortunately, neither of these outcomes, Christianizing nor stigmatizing, captures the essence of what Jesus laid his life down to secure. Notwithstanding, there are great advantages and disadvantages to a Christian society. One advantage is that a Christian society creates a common language for public moral discourse that then allows people to discuss and agree upon that which is understood as good for human flourishing and those things that are understood as negative or bad for human flourishing. One of the disadvantages is that Christian morality, without the change only Jesus is capable of bringing, often leads to cruelty and hypocrisy. And we find this in historical accounts of how small Christianized towns or cities or countries have treated unwed mothers, drug addicts, prostitutes, or any other person that's entangled with behavior that may be considered taboo or maybe a part of an ethnic group that's considered marginalized. So for reasons such as these, the church in both Europe and North America has been losing its place as the arbiter of public morality. And along with the general decline of Christian society, we're also witnessing a decline of churches. We ourselves are amidst a trend that suggests a vast majority of local churches are declining and will eventually close their doors. You see, the cultural backdrop in which we live can no longer be accurately categorized as Christian, which means that we can no longer assume that a stream of traditional, conservative, Christianized people are just going to show up, agree with our ideals, share our cubicles with us at work, or play on our kids' little league team. Instead, we must adapt absolutely everything that we do in the context of these four walls, in our communities, in service to our communities, and at work, so as to be engaged with the culture in which we live, rather than be found reminiscing about the culture we wish still existed. At this point, maybe you're wondering how we might adapt our efforts in our current cultural context. And I'm going to outline three suggestions, and that's what they are. They're suggestions as to how you might accomplish engaging in your sphere of influence and becoming a voice that's relevant in the current cultural context in which we live. The first of these suggestions I describe as this: retelling the culture's stories with the gospel. And one way that we can engage in the mission in our sphere of influence is to enter culture and retell the culture's stories in the context of what Jesus has done to rescue and restore all things to himself. To enter the culture's stories means to demonstrate sympathy for and a deep acquaintance with books or other forms of literature, blogs perhaps, internet resources, music, movies, and other mediums that accurately depict and express the hopes, dreams, stories of heroism and fears of what we would call mainstream culture. And this is pretty much what Jesus was found doing as he preached to the masses, interacted with individuals, and shared meals with neighbors. And one of the ways that Jesus engaged was by way of stories that we know as parables. And those were stories that made sense in the ears of those people who heard Jesus tell them. They resonated with gospel-centered truth. They identified cultural idols. And they engaged people in a philosophical level to the degree that Jesus was able to present himself as the only response to our fears, our hopes, and our aspirations. Because here's the thing, to retell the culture stories is to show that how only in Jesus can we have freedom without slavery, love without conditions, and live in community with others without injustice. See, previously the culture story exhorted people to be good father or mother, son or daughter, to live a decent, merciful, and good life. Today the cultural narrative has shifted and now encourages people to pursue their own interests, desires, and ambitions, to be free and self-defining, to include everyone as a means of ensuring social justice and equality. And what is unfolding is it's a fast-growing, economically vibrant, morally relativist, urban-oriented, spiritually curious, sexually polymorphous, and ethnically diverse cultural backdrop that is markedly different from that of previous generations. In order to enter the culture's narratives effectively, we must acquaint ourselves with them to the degree that we're able to identify which cultural practices can be embraced because they possess or allude to or communicate the idea of common grace, which practices are absolutely antithetical to the gospel and must therefore be rejected, and we also must identify which practices can be adapted in the context of Christian community. In addition to retelling the culture stories with the gospel, we need to be aware of the language that we use. And so I'm charging us to consider using what I'm going to describe as common language. In order to effectively engage the culture, it's important to consider the language we use. And in Christian enclaves, there's very little difference between the language used inside and outside the church. Technical biblical terms, they're very well known inside as well as outside church life. And documents, for example, documents of the early U.S. Congress, for example, they contain references from the Bible. And here's the thing. If we're going to effectively engage in the mission we're on, we should probably make an effort to avoid Christianisms or what would be considered tribal insider language, evangelical jargon, and other archaic forms of language that seek to do nothing more than set a spiritual tone rather than ensuring that our audience can easily understand the message of hope we're trying to convey. Another thing we need to be aware of is our tendency to use we-they language and disdainful jokes that mock people of different political beliefs and belief systems. These dismissive, disrespectful comments about those who differ with us should be avoided. You see, this type of speech, it does nothing more than polarize a room. And it also, it does another thing. It implies that Christianity and traditional American values or a particular political position or bent are one and the same. And unfortunately, traditional America and Christianity are two very distinct things. One is the church, a God-created culture. Another is it's a political or social culture that may render some of Christianity's moral beliefs, but it is not the same as the Christian church that Jesus himself is building. And another thing to consider is that the way. Instead, speak with the intention of forging meaningful relationships with the people in your sphere of influence. You see, the mission we're on, it's an all-hands-on-deck mission. It means that each of us must seek to engage in our sphere of influence. We must learn to use the gospel, the affirmation that despite our moral corruption, God has rescued us through Jesus' finished work. And we must use it to demonstrate respect, love, and tolerance in the public square toward those with whom we deeply differ. And here's the thing, church. Our level of respect and love should be highly visible and easily identified by the culture and grounded in the fact that we're not called to disdain the culture. Instead, we're called to engage the culture. And if we're called to engage the culture, with a counterculture, then there should be some tangible evidence of that counterculture in the way that we live in community with one another. So the last suggestion I have is that this life we call Christianity should be epitomized by lives lived in community that is countercultural. Because Jesus' finished work for us and his continued work in us and through us creates a culture. This culture is called the church. And we're not just a collection of sinners, because Jesus is massively transformational and he creates a counterculture that's distinct from but causes us to relate to the culture around us. What I mean here is that our rendering of community should be characterized by much more than an enclave mentality aimed at protecting certain values and rejecting others. There's much more to the dynamics of our community than protecting internal relationships and upholding moral precepts that we believe in. See, the way that we do life together should show the world how radically different we view cultural themes such as power, money, and sex. So regarding power, as a people, we're committed to power sharing and relationship building among races and socioeconomic classes that outside of the church are oftentimes alienated. And if you remember when we ran through the book of James, one of the talks we had was centered on the idea of Jesus or James challenging the church in Jerusalem to not show partiality to anyone, whether inside or outside the church. So basically, the main idea there is that people, as they interact with us, should feel welcomed and cared for rather than isolated and ignored. And we accomplish this by being a people deeply and practically committed to compassion and social justice, and deeply and practically committed to welcoming others into our community and introducing them to Jesus. When it comes to sex, our community should demonstrate that we avoid secular society's idolization of sex, and we also avoid traditional society's fear of sex. We should also exhibit love rather than hostility or fear toward those whose sexual life patterns are markedly different from ours. And rather than seeking to enter debates for the sole purpose of proving a point surrounding sexuality, we should seek to understand those with views that differ from ours, build relationships with them, and introduce them to Jesus. Because Jesus is the only remedy for our proclivity to pursue things that impede human flourishing. And when I mention the term human flourishing, what I'm talking about here is the restoration of a right relationship between us and God and us and other people. With regards to money, our view is characterized by a radically generous commitment of time, money, relationships, and living space in order to meet the needs of others, perhaps the poor, the immigrant, the economically and physically weak. And rather than viewing money as a power source, we view money as a means of demonstrating to a hurting world that there's a God who cares for their well-being. Ultimately, our engagement in community, the way we interact with one another in relationships, should leave the world looking from the outside in and wondering, how in the world do I become a part of that? And second to that, saying, hey, I could absolutely see myself living in the context of that community. So let's get real with this here. These three suggestions, if we isolate them to any degree from the finished work of Jesus, all they are simple gimmicks or moral exercises or things to add to your brilliant list of things to do to make yourself feel good about your identity as a human being. So let's bring this back into the context of what Jesus has done rather than what we are going to do. See, we started out talking about Abraham and how God called him out of his homeland, gave him a new identity and purpose. And we could easily approach a character like Abraham and conclude that he was very obedient and God honored his obedience and therefore God blessed him. But I'd like to offer a different perspective based on the fact that Abraham, given to his own credence, he never would have left his hometown. And in and of himself, he had no vision for the nations. In and of himself, he lacked faith whatsoever. You see, it was God's encounter with Abraham that produced faith in Abraham. Furthermore, just a short time after that encounter with God, Abraham was found making moves starkly inconsistent with his faith. his identity and his purpose when he lied about his relationship with his wife, and he ends up putting his entire family in a and the land in which he was living, he puts everybody in an extremely compromising situation. So here's a question for you. If it's Abraham's obedience that God honors, how do we reconcile Abraham's disobedience or the disobedience of every character we read about in the Bible? If God rewards obedience, should we also assume that he punishes disobedience? And if that's the case, we've got no hope at all, because there's not a human being in this room or alive today or who has ever lived who's done so in a perfect way. You see, each of us falls short of the standard of righteousness that we read about in the Bible. And if we're honest with ourselves, we fall short of our own self-instituted righteous standards. So when we read about Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Joseph and Moses and Job and David, Esther, and any of these other biblical characters that we could easily find ourselves describing as, hey, those guys have it all together, they're obedient, God blesses their obedience. When we find ourselves thinking about those people that we think have it all together, keep in mind that apart from Jesus, there is no one who is who they should be. There's no one capable of doing what Jesus has done. So as the worship team comes up here, I want to leave you considering this, that Jesus is the true and better Abraham who answered the call of God to leave all the comfortable and familiar, to in full perfect obedience go out into a hostile, violent world to create a new people of God. Jesus is the true and better Isaac who was not just offered up by his father on the mountaintop, but was truly sacrificed for us. And when God said to Abraham, "Now I know you love me because you did not withhold your son, You did not withhold your only son whom you love for me." Now we can look at God taking his son up on the mountain and sacrificing him and say, now we know that you love us because you did not withhold your son, your only son whom you love from us. Jesus is the true and better Jacob who wrestled and took the blow of justice we deserved so that we, like Jacob, only receive the wounds of grace to wake us up and discipline us. Jesus is the true and better Joseph who, at the right hand of the king, forgives those who betrayed and sold him and uses his new power to save them. Jesus is the true and better Moses who stands in the gap between the people of God and who mediates a new covenant. Jesus is the true and better Job, the truly innocent sufferer who then intercedes for us and saves his ignorant friends. Jesus is the true and better David whose victory becomes his people's victory, though they never lifted a stone to accomplish it themselves. Jesus is the true and better Esther who didn't just risk leaving an earthly palace, but lost the ultimate and heavenly one, who didn't just risk his life, but gave his life to save his people. Jesus is the true and better Jonah, who was cast out into the storm so that we could be brought in. Jesus is the real rock of Moses, the real Passover lamb, the innocent, perfect, helpless, slain, so the angel of death will pass over us. He's the true temple, the true prophet, the true priest, the true king, the true sacrifice, the true lamb, the true light of the world, the true bread of heaven, the ultimate and only resolution to the conflict between humanity and God. So if you're here today and you know Jesus, find rest in his finished work and engage in yours to influence the people in your sphere of influence. If you're here today and you'd like to learn more about Jesus, stick around after the service. I'd love to talk to you. Some of the leaders of the church who are here today would love to talk to you. And we can do that immediately following the service. Or if you're not interested in a face-to-face conversation at this point, if you're apprehensive about putting yourself out there like that, you can drop us a line using the Connect card you received when you arrived. That's all I got for you today. Let's go ahead and worship God together.